TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Alfred W. McCoy, The Making of the U.S. Surveillance State. In July 2013, an article appeared online in Tom Dispatch on the unprecedented powers of the U.S. surveillance state. Its author, University of Madison, Wisconsin Professor of History, Alfred McCoy, credits Edward Snowden for having revealed today's reality. And McCoy adds his perspective of the intriguing history that led up to this point. And he makes a few predictions as to what to expect in the near future. That article in Tom Dispatch caught the attention of radio host and writer Jeff Blankford. He allowed me to broadcast the highlights of his interview with Professor McCoy. McCoy studied Southeast Asian history at Yale before coming to Madison. In 1971, he wrote a book on the opium trade in Laos and discovered that the French financed their covert operations from the control of the Indochina drug trade. He also found evidence that after the U.S. replaced the French, the CIA took over the drug trade. He is radio host of Takes on the World, Jeff Blankford, with his first question.
You've traced more than a century of U.S. surveillance strategies from what we would now consider primitive to high tech. What impact, if any, do you think Snowden's revelations will have on the course of Washington's future surveillance strategies?
Over 100 years ago, Mark Twain put forward a very simple proposition when he wrote about the U.S. conquest and colonization of the Philippines. He said that by trampling on the rights of the helpless abroad, the American people learned the apathy to endure the like at home. In short, Twain argued that we couldn't have empire abroad and democracy at home. And now that Edward Snowden has revealed to us the incredible extent of NSA surveillance that the NSA, the National Security Agency, has effectively established an American domestic surveillance state, and indeed is working hard to build a global surveillance apparatus. So the question has been called.
What was interesting was that initially after the revelations, the polls that I heard seemed to think that most Americans were apathetic, as Mark Twain had predicted, that there was not the outrage by a large segment of the public about what the government was doing. If you're not doing anything wrong, why worry about it? And we've seen this kind of atmosphere. We had church hearings back in the 70s, which was an attempt to actually change, to get rid of COINTELPRO, some of the surveillance and counterintelligence techniques and operations the government was using. But we don't seem to have any significant numbers of members of Congress. We don't really see that kind of anger against this that we saw back in the 70s, and the mainstream media seems more preoccupied with talking about Edward Snowden and where he's going to go and whether he's a criminal or not than actually what the revelations were.
I think the difference between the 70s and now is that back in the 1970s, it was revealed that during our involvement in the Vietnam War, the FBI and the CIA were conducting massive counterintelligence and surveillance of the anti-war protesters, which represented a significant segment of American society. They were essentially the baby boom generation, the biggest generation in American history. And in 1974, the famous investigative reporter Seymour Hersh published an article in the New York Times saying that the CIA was running an illegal operation, Operation Chaos, that in violation of the CIA's charter, was conducting domestic surveillance of the anti-war protest movement here in the United States. That led, of course, as you mentioned, Senator Frank Church's very famous investigative committee, the Church Committee, to look into both Operation Chaos by the CIA and then the FBI's long-running counterintelligence program, discovering that, first of all, that the CIA's operation, which had a database, computer database with about 300,000 names in it, was completely illegal. And that second, that the FBI's counterintelligence operations were using illegal tactics that were a violation of democratic principles, t- to harass both the African-American civil rights movement and the anti-Vietnam protest movement. And because these were both significant sectors of American society, African-Americans, about 12 to 13% of all the American people, and the protesters were a very large baby boom generation, Congress acted, and what they did was they ratcheted back the establishment of a permanent surveillance state by creating the so-called FISA courts, requiring that any time a government agency wanted to do wiretapping inside the United States, they had to get a warrant from this special FISA court. So that represented a kind of substantial reform. And that was a continuation of a pattern that actually we've seen in the United States operating from the 1890s, if I could just place that in context, okay? And then come to the present and show what's changed and why we're in a very different circumstance and why Snowden's revelations are so important. Look, the origins of U.S. surveillance capacity, the capacity of the federal government to conduct surveillance of American citizens, dates back to the late 19th century. The United States came up with a synergy of brilliant innovations in data management, but the federal government, because of Constitution and the courts, had really no enforcement capacity beyond the customs barrier. And so when we intervened in the Philippines in 1898, we were suddenly in very new terrain. The U.S. Army, which plunged into the pacification of a dense, hostile Asian society that had just conducted two generations of political mobilization and launched the first national revolution in Asia that had defeated 300 years of Spanish colonial rule. And we were faced with the pacification of this insurgent republic. We had a very powerful army. We could smash anything, but we didn't know where to strike or how to strike. And so the U.S. Army created, in 1901, the first field intelligence unit in its 100-year history. And it placed in charge of that unit a man named Captain Ralph Van Diemen. He developed very sophisticated counterintelligence techniques. He did a kind of map of the entire Philippine political elite, collecting amazingly detailed data on thousands of Filipino political leaders. And then the U.S. Army Signal Corps laced the archipelago with 10,000 miles of telegraph wires, allowing for the instantaneous transmission of this sophisticated intelligence data. Moreover, the first U.S. colonial governor of the Philippines, William Howard Taft, created a colonial police force called the Philippines Constabulary that applied these very sophisticated counterintelligence penetration techniques to pacifying the Philippines. So by 1907, the combination of the Army's intelligence and this colonial police had pacified the country. Well, 10 years later, the United States joined World War I, and we were the only army on either side of the battle lines in World War I that didn't have an intelligence service of any description. So the U.S. Army, in April of 1917, established the Military Intelligence Division, and they appointed Captain, now Colonel Ralph Van Diemen, to be the founder of U.S. Army Military Intelligence, indeed, U.S. Internal Security. And he applied his Philippine experience, his rich, detailed Philippine experience, to constructing a counterintelligence apparatus in the United States. And very quickly, Military Intelligence Division grew from one employee himself to 1,700. And then he worked with the FBI, which had been recently established. And together they formed an alliance with a civilian group called the American Protective League, which had 350,000 badge-carrying civilian agents, counterintelligence agents. And they conducted the most massive surveillance of any society to date in human history. And after the war was over, the FBI and military intelligence, working with its kind of citizen vigilantes, conducted the notorious Luster raids in New York City, the Palmer raids across the northeastern United States, and they smashed strikes by the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, from New York Harbor all the way to Seattle. And the abuses were so extraordinary that when Republicans came into power in 1921, because all this had been done under a liberal Democratic president, Woodrow Wilson. So when the Republicans came into power, they were concerned about privacy. The Republican Attorney General, Harlan Fisk Stone, in 1924 said that a secret police is a potential danger to a free society. And he forced the FBI to cut all of its ties to citizen vigilante groups. And he proclaimed that the FBI was no longer interested in the political beliefs of any American, whatever they might be. And famously, 5 years later, in 1929, a Republican who was serving as Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson, abolished the cipher, the kind of code-breaking section of the Military Intelligence Division, saying, gentlemen, do not read each other's mail. Okay, so what we saw is a pattern established. In time of war, internal security expanded. When peacetide comes, through the partisan process, the opposite party cuts back on the surveillance apparatus radically, sharply, preventing the establishment of a standing or permanent surveillance state. That's the same pattern we saw during the Vietnam era. Massive expansion in internal surveillance by FBI and CIA during the 1960s, the era of the Vietnam protests, particularly under Republican conservative President Richard Nixon. But then in the 1970s, as the Vietnam War came to an end, Democrats, the opposite party, in a partisan process, ratchet back the surveillance state. Now, that pattern continued. Right after 9/11, President Bush illegally allowed the National Security Agency, the NSA, to start conducting systematic surveillance of Americans. They decided that metadata, the kind of stuff at the top of your email message, was not constitutionally protected, and therefore they allowed the NSA to start collecting metadata of all emails. The FBI built very quickly something called the Investigative Data Warehouse that had over 1 billion messages in it within 5 years. This was pretty systematic surveillance, okay? It was exposed by the New York Times in 2005. Is exposed by USA Today in an important investigative article in 2006. So when President Obama came into office, he was fully aware of the extent and the abuse, the illegality of things that had been done under President Bush. But he broke the partisan pattern. Instead of ratcheting back, cutting back on the surveillance that was done under his Republican predecessor, Obama has decided to make cyber surveillance and cyber warfare the centerpiece of a new defense posture. And so he's built upon the Bush surveillance, and he's begun building through the NSA a global surveillance apparatus, which is a kind of agile, low-cost vehicle for the perpetuation of U.S. global hegemony.
What you have described in this article, as I say, going back to the Philippines and the development of new technologies that enabled the surveillance state to begin. It's a very scary scenario, and even though whatever Congress seems to do, there seems to be a limit on what they will be allowed to even know.
Right. You said it's a frightening scenario, but I don't think it's overstated. 4 years ago, also writing in Time Dispatch, drawing upon my book, Policing America's Empire, I said, look, let's look at the long trajectory of U.S. history. Look at this pattern I just described of expansion of surveillance during wartime, and then when the rival party comes back into power after the war is over, ratcheting back on the surveillance apparatus. Okay, and in 2009, I said, okay, it was the start of the Obama administration. I said, back in 2009, we are just a few tweaks away from developing a domestic surveillance state in the United States. I said, we're almost there. It could happen.
And you were right.
I was right. In other words, and historians actually, I think, have a terrible track record in using history, using the past to predict the future. But, if you do it right, if you look at the sort of trajectory, the overarching trajectory, not the details, nobody can do that, you can see trends. And you can see the shape of the trends and where we're heading, right? That allows you to sort through all the kind of noise of the daily press, all the sensationalism, all the usual stuff that we get in our media. And this larger history that I just described to you, that allows us to see the trajectory. And I think now that if you look at the situation we're in, that Congress's capacity to cut this back, I think, is fairly limited. Let me explain. In 2012, when President Obama came out with his defense budget, this was a point where he'd been in office long enough where he understood things, where he could really begin to take control. He could see the shape of the future. All right, and as we all know, many of the attributes of U.S. global power that have existed for the past 50 years are beginning to wane. Back in 1950, we had something like half of world trade under our control. China is on the edge of passing us as the world's number one economic power. The World Bank predicts by 2016 China will have about 18% of world trade, and we'll have just 17%. We'll become the number two world power, okay? So clearly, although our absolute economic strength is still quite impressive, relatively, we've presided over an era, half century, of global growth. It's a compliment to U.S. global power, okay, that we've been able to do this. Well, nonetheless, our relative power is waning. So how do we maintain our world leadership? President Obama has cut back in his 2012 defense budget infantry by 14%. He's cutting back on all the conventional heavy metal weaponry, the aircraft, the tanks, the trucks, the destroyers, the cruisers, all the rest of it. And what he's doing is he's moving us, if you read his budget, into an era of cyber warfare and space warfare. And he's building a new agile global apparatus, low cost, for the perpetuation of U.S. global power. In 2009, Obama established the U.S. Cyber Command, right, which declared cyberspace to be a domain of military conflict, just like air, land, and sea. And he established the U.S. Cyber Command, and he appointed as the head of the U.S. Cyber Command General Keith Alexander, who's concurrently, of course, the head of the NSA, the man who's been walking around Congress yesterday lobbying intensely against the amendment by Representative Amash of Michigan, trying to stop Congress from cutting back NSA's right to unchecked surveillance. This is more power in the hands of a single man than anybody has ever had before. So look, the NSA, simultaneously under its very operations, working with its counterpart British intelligence, has begun tapping into fiber optic cables all across the United States. And then its counterpart agency in the UK, the Government Communications Headquarters, GCHQ, starting in 2011 in a project launched jointly with the NSA, sank 200 probes into the transatlantic cables and began harvesting 600 messages a month. In March of this year, the NSA is believed to have harvested 97 billion messages. That's over a trillion messages a year from the United States and around the world. The fiber optic cables, because all of our communications, telephone and email, all of our communications, text and voice, now go through these fiber optic cables. It's an amazing centralization of all human communication. So by sinking probes into just a few thousand cables, you can basically scoop up the world's communications, all right? That's what NSA is doing. Simultaneously, the Obama administration has created brand new headquarters constructed at the cost of nearly $2 billion for the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency that's monitoring all the communications in the skies above. So it's kind of NSA tapping into the fiber optic cables in the ground below while the NGIA, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, is developing an apparatus to surveil all the communications in the skies above. The Obama administration has been building and launching a flotilla of 99 Global Hawk drones. Now, these are not like the Reapers and Predators that are armed with missiles that are really kind of combat-oriented. The Global Hawk is a surveillance drone that has continuous 20-hour flight and can take, very sharp images for a 100-mile radius and, more importantly for our purposes, suck up all audio communications, two-way radios, local cell phone towers, stuff that's going from a cell phone to a tower. It can scoop that up for a 100-mile radius. So we're developing a comprehensive apparatus. Simultaneously, the Air Force has launched the world's first space drone, the X-37B, which has been successfully tested since April 2010. And it can carry missiles to knock out any rival global telecommunication satellite system. Most of the U.S. military command, control, and communications goes through satellites. And we have had, for the better part of 60 years, the world a monopoly on satellite communications. We have the world's only global satellite system. China, by 2020, will have the world's second satellite system. And in 2007, China conducted an experiment. They shot a missile up, and they knocked out one of their own orbiting satellites. So the age of space warfare has arrived. So the combination of NSA monitoring the fiber optic cables, and the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, along with the Air Force, monitoring all surface communications, means that we have built or are on the edge of completing the world's first truly global surveillance apparatus. We now are at a unique historical moment. Edward Snowden has put the issue on the front page of the paper. You know, those NSA slides that the Washington Post has published, any American can go and look at those slides and see the scope and the scale of this domestic surveillance, right? And I think the ACLU is very well aware that this is not just passive. It's not just a question, well, we have nothing to hide. You know, my phone calls to my family, my visa bills, so what if they're monitoring that? Well, they're not worried about that. They're worried about deviance of any sort. And we've seen that the American state, like all states, has a tendency to consider any form of challenge to its authority to be deviance. I mean, we've seen the IRS has been monitoring or slowing the applications for the various Tea Party affiliates. We know that environmental activists are under fairly strict surveillance with their mail being monitored. All right, so basically anybody that is going to challenge, exercise their constitutional rights, and become an activist that's going to challenge the current dispensation anyway, faces the risk of harassment. This stuff is not benign. It's just not. It's used against anybody, left, center, or right, who's going to be in any way politically active. And it's that very small percentage of the population, all right, that are going to be subjected to the harassment and the power that this surveillance allows. You know, let's we forget, J. Edgar Hoover, all right, for 30 years, right, protected his bureau, the FBI, from any meaningful legislative or congressional oversight because Hoover had his private files where he had all of the financial and sexual derelictions of influential Americans on the file, and nobody dared challenge him. All right, so this stuff is never benign, all right? It's used selectively to target those that are politically active. And without these activists, okay, without people like Reverend Martin Luther King, who was, by the way, subject to intensive FBI surveillance and had lots of incriminating information collected about him, without people like Martin Luther King, you know, think about what King represented, the movement that he led, the change that made in the quality of American life, absolutely critical. Well, you know, government wasn't doing that by itself. It was a movement. Movements for change always are the way that the American people express their political will. But with this surveillance capacity, the state can actually cripple the capacity of the civil society and ordinary citizens to change the direction of their government. And the American state will not prosper. And if a society that stills dissent, okay, that stills critics, is a society that doesn't adapt, as all societies and their governments must do continuously. I would argue that using this apparatus, and it will be used, all right, allowing this accretion of power, allowing this apparatus to exist, allowing it to operate without any functional oversight, and there is no oversight, okay, it has a potential risk. As Harlan Fiske said back in 1924, a secret police is a potential threat to a free society. And that remains as true today as it was back in 1924.
Well, this interesting Brigadier General Von Daemon would look back on what he has achieved with a big smile on his face. You say he is the father of military intelligence, and most Americans have never heard his name.
Right. And actually, he's also, interestingly enough, the father of the American blacklist, because as I explained, the system he ran in the Philippines was used politically, all right? As I said, it's not benign. Under William Howard Taft and Captain Van Diemen, that intelligence apparatus did two things. First of all, it not only monitored the political activities of Filipinos in all discourse, in all public space, press, and public speech, okay, but it penetrated the homes. It collected all kinds of incriminating information about the two things, of course, that such incriminating information always has, sex, sexual peccadilloes, and financial malfeasance. Now, those that were sympathetic to the U.S. colonial regime found their peccadilloes buried within the files of the U.S. colonial security apparatus. those who were critics of the U.S. colonial regime found their peccadilloes released to the press and their reputations destroyed. That's the way the system operates. And that's the risk to any democracy, that massive amounts of information, all right, can be used against individual critics. Well, let's go back to Van Diemen. He retired as a major general from the U.S. Army in 1929. He retired to San Diego and bought himself a nice, comfortable bungalow. And he and his wife was quite a formidable woman. She was the first woman to ever fly on an aircraft. They set up a private intelligence service because, as I explained earlier, that during the 1920s, you know, Congress and the courts had cut back on the domestic surveillance apparatus. So Van Diemen filled that void, and he ran a kind of private exchange service of intelligence between the Red Squads in San Diego and Los Angeles, the in-the-city police, Office of Naval Intelligence, U.S. Army Military Intelligence, and then business associations had their own intelligence services. And he assembled all this information. He compiled dossiers on 250,000 Americans, particularly those in Hollywood, suspected of subversion. And he served as an informal conduit, moving incriminating information from classified government files into the hands of anti-communist activists who would blacklist people. And it's believed, for example, in 1950, when Congresswoman Helen Gahagan Douglas ran against Congressman Richard Nixon for the Senate seat from the state of California, Van Diemen is believed in his files are believed to have been the source of the so-called pink sheets that Nixon circulated as rallies implicating or implying that Helen Gahagan Douglas was a communist or a communist sympathizer, that she was pink. And that, of course, played a critical role in election in Nixon's electoral victory in 1950, putting him on a path to presidency of the United States.
That was Alfred W. McCoy, professor of history at the University of Madison, Wisconsin. He was interviewed by Jeff Blankfort, radio host and journalist, on the making of the U.S. surveillance state. That's a July 2013 article by McCoy, published online at Tom Dispatch. Professor McCoy is the author of The Politics of Heroin and A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror, a film based in part on that book, Taxi to the Dark Side, won the Oscar for Best Documentary Feature in 2008. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also find the links to the original 35-minute broadcast and to the text in Tom Dispatch. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.